This is A-State Connections on KASU. I'm Jonathan Reeves. This is the weekly segment called A-State Connections and Created State, Making Connections That Count. In this segment, you'll hear a couple of presentations going back to the Created State Virtual Symposium in April. These presentations are from the College of Education and Behavioral Science. First is Emily Burke and Landon Bonner with their presentation, Is Peer Pressure Really the Biggest Factor in Teen Drug Use?
The purpose of the research was mainly to determine two things. Why do teens use drugs, and are our society's most widespread beliefs regarding teen drug use actually accurate? The better understanding we have of why teens use drugs, the better chance we have of preventing it in the future. The most common beliefs regarding why teens use drugs are that they do it in order to fit into a group or because they feel pressured by their peers. In order to conduct this study, participants who had used drugs were asked to rate 22 potential reasons for drug use on a 5-point scale. 1 being strongly disagree, and 5 being strongly agree.
Okay, so now we're quickly going to go over some demographics of the survey. So of all the people that said they had used drugs at least once, it totaled to about 50. And a majority of those people, as you can see on the table, range between the age of 18 and 22. And then below that, you can see of the 50 that said yes, they was about evenly split in regards to sex, with 24 being male and 26 being female. Continuing on with the demographics, as you can see, 66% of the subjects were Caucasian, followed by African American, and a 3-way tie for third among Asian, Latino, and other. Now, in regards to class level, 70% were either freshman or sophomore, with the remaining 30% being juniors or seniors. Okay, now moving on to the actual results. So in the table below, you have the different reasons that teens rated from 5 to 1. And those listed at the top had the highest average rating, and those at the bottom had the lowest average rating. And as you can see, the first 5 are the only ones above 3, meaning that the teens are most likely to use drugs because of those reasons are the ones below them. And those reasons included using drugs out of curiosity, using drugs to get high, using drugs to have fun, using drugs to feel happy, and using drugs to feel less stressed. You do not see things such as fitting in, use them because you saw a family member doing them, or doing them to be cool, or using them to fit in. So continuing on with the rest of the results, these are the reasons that were rated the lowest of them all. And as you can see, some of them you would expect to be higher, such as getting back at your parents, using drugs because you saw someone else, like a family member, doing them, using them to rebel, using them to look cool, using them to be part of a group, and using them to fit in with important friends were all rated very low compared to things such as happy and getting high and curiosity. And so that's a pretty big surprise to some people, considering they would probably have those as such as fitting in and looking cool as higher than curiosity and having fun. So in conclusion, teens were more likely to use drugs out of curiosity, to feel happy, for fun, or another physical effect such as alleviating stress. And they were least likely to use drugs in rebellion, to fit in, because they saw a family member do it, or to appear cool in front of their peers. And we can use results from studies like this to help adjust and adapt our current drug prevention strategies to help lower teen drug use even more.
That was Landon Bonner and Emily Burke. Next is Zoe Bryan with her presentation, Effects of Support Dogs on Eyewitness Anxiety During Testimony.
Eyewitness evidence is a critical aspect of the criminal justice system. Oftentimes, it is the first activity to be performed by police officers in a criminal investigation. A successful interview can help provide initial leads in the investigation, connect investigators with other eyewitnesses, or identify suspects. And furthermore, once a defendant is standing trial, the initial interview may be reused as evidence to help convict the criminal. Negative effects of eyewitness evidence is that in many cases, the only witness to a crime is the victim. And when questioning a victim, it can cause uncomfortable memories to resurface in a non-therapeutic setting and cause further trauma in the victim. In the courtroom, providing testimony is particularly anxiety-provoking. From being simply questioned to the confusion of not knowing how the system works, embarrassment of having to relive the abuse in front of strangers and loved ones, the fear of not being believed, fear of retribution, from the verdict, and a fear increased by the presence of the abuser in the courtroom. This anxiety is found more with younger children. However, even older individuals have been shown to have pronounced negative feelings towards questioning. The criminal justice system do have tools to help with these problems, some of them being special techniques that police officers use to help question the victim, such as keeping the initial interview as short as possible, avoid any physical or verbal actions that can be seen as threatening towards the victim, and avoid wording questions in a judgmental tone. It is also common for a victim advocate to be present during the interview to support the needs of the victim. Now, during courtroom testimonies, there are accommodations that are sometimes utilized, particularly with children, such as adult attendant, demonstrative objects like anatomical dolls, puppets, drawings, and mannequins. There are alternative methods to testifying, such as closed-circuit television and videotape depositions, and even the removal of specified people from the courtroom, like any press present. Some jurisdictions in the United States have additional accommodations allowing trained support dogs to accompany a child in the stand during testimony. Canine companions specifically were selected to use the courtroom due to their effects on decreasing stress. The goal for this research was to examine the effectiveness of therapy dogs in reducing eyewitness anxiety in as realistic a situation as possible. Participants were pre-screened for fears, allergies, or dislikes towards large dogs. Two participants indicated such and were automatically assigned to the control condition. This small courtroom was built with a mini grant that Professor Christopher Peters wrote and built by the University Theater Department. The whole thing, props, and all cost less than $2,000. We followed a standard eyewitness testimony setup, which the prosecuting attorney helped us plan out. Our participants' anxiety levels increased once entering the room and stayed at a high level until they were given either of the conditions. As a result showed, anxiety with the presentation of the dog was significantly lower than with the water. Even when a non-victim is in a clearly mock situation, being an eyewitness is an extremely anxiety-provoking event, but the anxiety can be helped by the use of a trained therapy dog.
That was Zoe Bryan. Next is Jay Lee Tribble and Toby Stipp. Their presentation is titled, Effects of Rose's Law on Jury Decision-Making, 10 Years Later.
Rose's Law was officially passed to change the terminology for mental retardation to intellectual disability, and this change was recorded in the newest edition of the DSM. According to the DSM, individuals with intellectual disability suffer from different deficits, including lack of reasoning, abstract thinking, and judgment. What's important to note here is that the characteristics are the same for mental retardation, so the only change has been the terminology itself. Past research has also found that because of these deficits, these individuals are more easily swayed by coercion. In a past study conducted by Peters, Hitchcock, and Strait, the researchers were interested in the effects of using different terminology for the disorder on jury decision-making specifically. And they were particularly interested in the effect of this in cases of coercion, knowing that past research has found that intellectually disabled people are more susceptible to it. And what the researchers found is that when heavily coerced, a defendant who is labeled with intellectual disability as opposed to mental retardation was more likely to be found guilty by mock jurors. So the present research is essentially a replication of this study in order to determine if views of guilt have changed since the original study was conducted and it now being 10 years since the passing of Rose's Law.
Our study included 162 undergraduate students. Due to campus closure, we were unable to run and analyze data from the remaining 267 original students. Our mean age was 19 years. We had predominantly female, predominantly Caucasian. We had a 2x3 between subjects factorial. Our independent variables were diagnosis, terminology, and coerciveness. We also had one dependent variable, which was the likelihood of granting a guilty verdict. For our procedure, we gave participants a fictional trial summary, which included a chat room conversation between the defendant and an undercover agent. The defendant was either labeled with intellectual disability or mental retardation, and the agent either heavily, mildly, or did not coerce the defendant to agree with meeting with them in person to have sex. Afterwards, we gave a questionnaire to the participants, which included two manipulation checks, demographic questions, and asked the participants to rank on a scale of 1 to 7, the likelihood that they would grant a guilty verdict to the defendant. For our study, we ran a two-way factorial analysis of variance. For diagnosis terminology, we found a marginally significant main effect. Although there was no statistical significance, we do see a difference between the two terminologies. We also found a significant main effect of coerciveness on likelihood of voting guilty. Specifically, we found that participants were less likely to vote guilty when a defendant was heavily coerced than when a defendant was mildly coerced or not coerced at all. Finally, we found a marginally significant interaction between terminology and coerciveness. Specifically, we found that a defendant labeled with intellectual disability was more likely to be found guilty than if labeled with mental retardation in the mild coercion condition.
Overall, the results obtained in this study were similar to those obtained in the original study. In particular, when the defendant was labeled with intellectual disability as opposed to mental retardation, they were more likely to be found guilty by mock jurors. Now, contrary to the original study, this effect occurred when the defendant was mildly coerced, and this is likely due to participants seeing heavy coercion on part of law enforcement as unacceptable and negative, despite the type of disability. Now, there are some limitations present as well. As indicated earlier, our results are only based on a portion of the data that was collected, and we believe that if we had been able to run analyses on the entire data set, then some of our marginal effects would have actually reached significance. In addition, using a convenient sample, such as college students, is not representative of the entire population of people that serve on juries. In addition, our sample was predominantly female, so it is possible that gender differences could have affected the results. The present research supports the notion that people remain unaware of the interchangeability between intellectual disability and mental retardation, and as a result, people commonly associate the two terms with different disorders. Treatment of people based on the terminology used is thus different. Future research should attempt to address the limitations that were previously discussed, as well as examine the different subject variables that had some imbalances, perceptions of law enforcement officials in regard to coercion, and seeing if an educational strategy in regard to the terminologies could actually help to eliminate some of these differences.
That was Jaylee Tribble and Toby Stipp. The final presentation is from Elise Nooner and Eleanor Pulliam with their presentation, Differences in Attitudes Toward Statistics in Traditional versus Online Courses.
Differences in Attitudes Toward Statistics in Traditional versus Online Courses. My name is Elise Nooner. Within the last few years, online courses have increased in popularity as technology has advanced. Even in recent weeks, we have witnessed traditional courses quickly forced online. In tandem with this heightened popularity of e-learning, questions have been raised not just about the efficacy of online courses, but how students feel about them compared to traditional courses. In this research study, an online course is defined as a course in which all instruction and assignments are delivered through the internet. A traditional course is characterized by the method of delivering all or most instruction in a face-to-face lecture or classroom-based setting. To assess potential differences between traditional and online undergraduate statistics courses, our research team utilized a Survey of Attitudes Toward Statistics 36. We sought and received permission from its creator, Dr. Candice Shao, to use it free of charge for 1 year.
My name is Eleanor Pulliam. The SATS 36 is a valid, reliable, and copyrighted instrument. It has been used widely in research conducted in the United States and internationally. The SATS 36 consists of 36 prompt items scored on a Likert scale from 1 to 7, which assess 6 attitude components. These being affect, or students' positive and negative feelings concerning statistics, cognitive competence, students' attitudes about their intellectual knowledge and skills when applied to statistics, value, or students' attitudes about the usefulness, relevance, and worth of statistics in personal and professional life, difficulty, students' attitudes about the difficulty of statistics as a subject, interest, which is students' level of individual interest in statistics, and effort, the amount of work students expend to learn statistics. We received approval from the A-State Institutional Review Board for this study, and with the assistance of course professors, the survey was distributed online via Qualtrics to students enrolled in statistics courses in the spring 2020 term at 4 universities in the Mid-South: Arkansas State University Jonesboro, Arkansas State University Querétaro, or ASUQ, University of Arkansas Little Rock, UALR, and University of Memphis, U of M. Of these universities, 91 students were enrolled online and 108 in traditional statistics courses. The Qualtrics link containing the stats remained available to students for the first 2 weeks of their course. This was in order to ensure students' true first impression attitudes were reflected in our survey results. The data was then collected, entered, and analyzed in IBM SPSS 24 using a multivariate analysis of variance, MANOVA, with the instructional format traditional versus online being the independent variable and the six attitude components the dependent variables. Preliminary assumption testing was conducted to check for normality, linearity, univariate and multivariate outliers, homogeneity of variance-covariance matrices, and multicollinearity. Although some minor violations were noted, these did not impact the overall results. Additional demographic characteristics of students who completed the survey are noted in Table 1. Table 2 shows descriptive statistics on the six attitude components for students in online and traditional courses. As noted in Table 3, there was a statistically significant difference between attitudes toward online and traditional statistics courses on the combined dependent variables. When the results for the six dependent variables of the attitude components were considered separately, two differences reached statistical significance, using a Bonferroni adjusted alpha level of 0.008. These were affect and difficulty. An inspection of the mean scores indicated that students enrolled in the traditional courses reported higher levels of positive affect and lower levels of difficulty. In other words, these students felt more positive about the course and thought it would be easier compared to students enrolled in online statistics courses.
Although this was a preliminary study, findings suggest important differences in initial attitudes between students taking online compared to face-to-face courses. Our plan was to conduct a follow-up post-test with these same students at the end of the spring 2020 term. However, all of these students will not be taking statistics online, so the comparisons between course formats will not hold. Still, we hope to continue this research in future semesters to track changes in attitudes toward statistics for these instructional formats. With an increase in online instruction expected, it will be especially important to address the attitudes of affect and difficulty. It seems likely that students who feel more positive about taking a statistics course and believe it will not be difficult will be destined to have better learning outcomes.
That was Elise Nooner and Eleanor Pulliam. To hear more of the Created State Podcast, you can subscribe to the Created State Podcast at the Created State Podcast page on KASU.org. It's also available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, wherever you get podcasts is where you can listen to Created State Podcast. Also, take KASU with you wherever you go. Listen to podcast segments on the new KASU app. Tell others about the Created State Podcast and also leave us a 5-star review. That helps us to be able to get this podcast out to more listeners. We'd love to hear from you as always. You can contact me at jreaves@astate.edu. I'm Jonathan Reeves. This is A-State Connections in Created State, making connections that count. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great day.